From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Sam McCollum is my guest. Sam McCollum played professional football for the Minnesota Vikings and the Seattle Seahawks. He played in Super Bowl IX back in 1975. I'll bet that you never played in any Super Bowls, am I right? But Sam has. Sam McCollum, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Glad to be here.
Was the atmosphere of the Super Bowl as insane as it is now back in 1975?
It was a lot different. I mean, obviously it wasn't quite as big and wasn't quite as vocal as it is today, but yeah, at the time it was, for me particularly, coming out of a small school like I did in Montana and going to the first Super Bowl and then being played in New Orleans, no less. So just the atmosphere in New Orleans made it kind of hectic, and Bourbon Street was pretty spectacular in those days.
Yeah. Well, like, for instance, what was going on in New Orleans that week?
Well, you can imagine, I mean, half the country seems like they just kind of crowded into those little areas down Bourbon Street and the French Quarters, and so they had lots going on. They wouldn't even bring our family in until the Friday before the game because they didn't want the distractions for us, but there were so many people, and I told a story to a friend of mine just over the weekend. I says, you know, when you knew it was a big deal, and here I walk into a room, one of my teammates, a guy named Jim Marshall, who played like 17 years in the league, and I walk in the room, and I sit in the room with him, is Ken Norton and Bill Cosby in his hotel room, just hanging around. They're just hanging around having a cigar, and I walked in the room, introduced me to these guys, and about fell down. I couldn't believe, there they're sitting there, no big deal. And it was like that throughout the entire week. It was just everywhere you turned, there was somebody you didn't expect to see, but there were huge players everywhere you turned. I met Harry Belafonte, Diana Ross, they were all around. It was incredible. So it was much more subdued. I got the list of all the events in New York going on this week in New York, and it's ridiculous. When I look at the amount of events starting Tuesday through the game time on Sunday, it's really ridiculous.
Was there a two-week period in 1975 between the championships and the Super Bowl?
Yes, it was. I don't know when that started, but I know when my first year it was definitely a two-week time delay.
But there weren't as many playoffs to get to the Super Bowl as there are now. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. No, you didn't have the extra wild card game, and you didn't have as many divisions at that time. So yeah, it was only there was a winner, then there was a championship, and you played. So it was three games where some guys now play four.
Right, right. And I guess football was not quite as big as it is now. I mean, it's so huge now.
Yeah, and it's got to be so big. It's got to be so corporate. Back then, they tried to tell us it was all just a game. But the corporate side and the business side of it just kept creeping more and more into the arena itself. And now it's a big corporation, and it's just not the players who are incorporated. The coaches have their own organizations, and every team obviously has theirs. So it's a big corporation is what it is, and they kind of intermingle with each other. So and of course you didn't have sports television back then. You didn't have ESPN to focus on everything that you did as they try to fill in all their dead space. So it was really a weekend deal, and Monday Night Football became very popular back then. So it took off, and no doubt it did, but nothing like it is today.
So actually, kind of during the years that you were playing, it really grew a lot.
Yeah, it really, really did grow tremendous, because at the time, you figure, when I came in 1974, they had just started really early Monday Night Football a couple years before, so it was really just taken off with the Howard Cosells and the Don Meredith and the Frank Giffords were the big celebrities at the time, and they only had football on Sunday nights and Sundays. I mean, Monday nights and Sundays. Now you got it Thursdays, you got Saturdays, and any other day they can fit it in. So it was just taken off, and it really just kind of kicked me. I think the fact that the Super Bowl became so, so popular with so many people, it just kind of spread quite quickly.
Your Super Bowl was kind of a low-scoring game. Has the style of play changed a lot?
Well, the style of play has, because the defenses for so long had gotten to be so big and so strong, And the people didn't want to see a defensive struggle. They want to see more scoring. So the rules of the game with the contact on receivers, with the contact on offensive linemen, with the offensive lineman not being able to chop block or clip a guy when he's running down the field. So they changed a lot of rules to give an opportunity for the offense to score more points. And that's because it's all built for television. You know, one of the biggest changes they made was turf, because for so long, a lot of teams couldn't afford or didn't want to put artificial turf in because of the cost. So you played in dirt, and after the fall came, it was dirt. It wasn't grass, it was dirt. And so after a while, you couldn't see the numbers on the field. So trying to broadcast a game, I remember one came, I think it was Summerall broadcast the game, so there goes the guy down the field. He couldn't tell what number he was because it's all covered in mud. So the advent of artificial turf really wasn't for the players. It was really for the television audience, so they can see who people were.
That's pretty funny. So how did you, we're talking with Sam McCollum, and he played professional football. How did you become a professional football player? When did the path to pro football begin for you?
Well, as a junior in college, I had a very good junior year playing at Montana State in Bozeman, Montana. And I got contacted by some of the teams at that time that they were looking at me as a possible player to play in the NFL. And I had never been to an NFL game, really hadn't really watched other than, you know, the weekend you'll go to your fraternity and everybody gets around and just, you know, hangs around. But so it really didn't kind of cross my mind until that time. That was just prior to my junior year. And then, after my junior year. And then my senior year, there was a lot of people around checking and noticing. And so a lot of scouts at our games. And there was actually two of us on the team, a guy named Bill Kohler that got drafted by Cincinnati at the time in the first round. So there was a couple guys there that they were looking at. So that's when it became a reality that I could do that. So then I got drafted in the spring of 1974 and had an opportunity to go play.
And you were drafted by the Vikings. Was that something you wanted?
No, it was not at all. I mean, at that time, the team everybody wanted to play for was either the Cowboys or the Rams or the Jets, and you wanted to be the San Francisco 49ers. You wanted to be places away from Minnesota. As ironically, my family had left Montana when I was in college and moved to Minnesota, so I spent some holidays in Christmas time and the summertime there, and I knew I didn't want to play there because in the wintertime it was very cold, and they still played outside. And so when I got the call from the team, particularly the Vikings, I was stunned because the Cowboys had called me the day before, so they're going to draft me. And they didn't do it. I was very upset. And the first thing the next morning, I got a call from the Vikings. I thought they were kidding me. I thought it was a joke. Really did. Because that was the last place I thought I was going to end up at. As it turned out, it actually worked out quite well. So, but I was very cold.
And you had two stints with the Vikings in the beginning and end of your career?
That's correct. The first 2 years there was as a rookie going in there in 74 and 75, and then I came in the expansion draft, which seeded the team Seattle. At the same time, Tampa Bay became a team in the league at the same time. So, and I came out here at the expansion draft because the new head coach of the team was a assistant coach with the Vikings, a guy named Jack Patera. So he knew me and a number of the other young guys that he brought out here to help seed this team. And I was here for 6 years, and then I'm going back to Minnesota for the last 2 years of my career. So,
and when you first came to play for the Vikings, you're a receiver, and what was that? Were you scared? Were you nervous? What about your very first professional game? What was that like?
Well, this was in August of 1974, and my very first game was the veterans were out on strike at the time. They were fighting for better wages and having for all kinds of, you know, training camp and all those other things, because it was really poor man's wages. You had $100 a week to practice and play football in those years, and they had 6 weeks of summer training camp before they started the season. And those were the days where contracts were guaranteed. So a lot of guys were unhappy about that. And also injuries. There was no such thing as injury protection. If you got injured and they paid you your contract and you got nothing else to go with, they just kick you to the curb. So there was a lot of strike going on. So when I went to training camp in 1974, there was just rookies there, and a very small number of veterans that crossed the line. The guys that crossed were the ones that were on the fence to make the team anyway. So, but we had mostly just rookies, and we were had the world pretty much to ourselves. So it was pretty easy in that scenario. But then we had our very first game. I'll never forget. It was in Denver, and we go out to Denver, and the first time I walk into a stadium like that size was pretty eye opening. And we played the game with mostly rookies and some veterans, and it was, you know, it didn't hit me at all that there was a big difference, because I'm playing against guys that are all mostly my age. And then the next week, the veterans come back in the training camp, and we go to play Miami in Miami, which was a Super Bowl rematch from the 1974 Super Bowls. And it was in Miami, and I have a chance to meet Howard Cosell and the gang, and it going to be on national television. And that was the first time it really hit that this was a big deal.
What did you have feelings about the broadcasters? Kurt Gowdy does the call on your Super Bowl, calls you a rookie.
That's true.
Did you have emotional feelings toward the announcers, or did you not? Did you maybe because you were playing, you didn't get a chance to hear it? Because in those days, they didn't have VCRs and whatnot.
No, they didn't. And you didn't hear much at all. And the only time you got the announcers when you saw them in the hotels before the games, or they'd want to film something with you as an human interest story type thing. And meeting Howard Cosell and Frank Gifford and, you know, Danny Don Meredith at the time of the hotel, it was very it's quite humbling to say, listen, I walked into the lobby while we were there the day of the game, and they come in, and Howard Cosell said, Sammy McCollum from Montana State University. I'm thinking, how in the hell does he know me, of all people? But he had done his homework. So that was really the experience I had with these guys. I got to know a lot of these guys through the year. Dick Emberg was a guy I got to know, and yeah. Pat Summerall, I got to know these guys. So, but you got to know them because they're always around. Not because you heard them do your game, because they really didn't, because they said there was no VCRs to listen to anything. It was just because before the game you'd see them in the different places and you get to talk to them at that time.
Did players study films during the week of their games?
Oh yeah, that was our only communication those days was with the teams during the week was film study. And we'd study with the coaches, because this was the days before the advent of VCRs, and so you had these reel-to-reel films that you have to put on, and you'd weed it through like the old days of your audiovisual class in high school. So
yeah.
So we'd watch the whole time, and we'd watch it, and we'd start the preparation on Mondays after the game. We either watched the game, or we'd watch the next week's opponent, and then we'd take off Tuesday, and then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday we'd watch film to get ready to play on Sunday. So, but we watched a lot of, you'd be almost required to watch at least, you know, 15 or 20 hours of film during the course of the week to get ready for your team. But nowadays, they give these guys just DVDs, they take them home with them, and they drop in their players at home, that's what they watch, they put them in their cars, and they can do whatever they want with them, so it's pretty easy. what some teams are doing right now, they got their iPads, they got the website, they drop all their game films on the website, you can go out there on the website, and they can actually give these guys iPads somehow. You go and you pull up the particular game you're watching, you tap on your iPad, you watch on your iPad, no matter where you're at. So it's pretty spiffy.
Yeah, I know, the technology has really changed, and watching the games now on, you know, your big high-def screen, it's much easier to watch them on TV than it is to actually go down to the stadium and see them.
It really is. The angles and all the different angles of the televisions and everything these days is pretty amazing. When you look at the different cameras, in particular if you watch a game with the camera on the field, and where it looks like you're standing right next to it, nothing is actually on a piece of wire that kind of floats above the screen, and you can look up and almost touch it sometimes, that's how close it is to you. So it really, they've done an amazing job of really getting the people involved in the game by seeing a different side of it than the old days. And I think high definition television has really made you feel like you're sitting right there. So it's pretty amazing, the technology today.
We're talking with Sam McCollum, former professional football player. I'm sure you made many memorable catches. Can you recall one for us?
Memorable catches?
Yeah.
Wow. the top of my head. Well, yes, I remember the first catch, the first official catch of the Seattle Seahawks. I'm not the first official touchdown. And it's the Lions used a crossing route. I caught it in the corner of the end zone for the first touchdown in the history of the team. So that one does stick out to me. I did the same thing in preseason as well, so I did. But the regular season one actually counted, so that's one I remember that sticks out.
Well, on our show here a couple of weeks ago, we had Steve Fainaro. He's the author of League of Denial. He's written a book and film about the head trauma to NFL players and the NFL's reluctance to accept responsibility for all that. Do you have any feelings about that?
Well, I think the NFL, like any big organization or big corporation, will come to the table of realization more times unwillingly, and this is what the case has had with the NFL. For so long, they didn't want to admit that there was an issue with the concussions and the process for dealing with them until it really smacked them in the face. And now they're being very, very proactive in a lot of ways trying to provide for players out there. And that's in part due to the fact they want their game to survive. Because if John Q. Public out there sees that their son's going to end up this way and they're not going to let their sons play, and then the integrity of the game itself starts to go down and eventually it dies, just like boxing basically. So they're being proactive, but for so long they didn't, and they didn't want to admit it because it brought a light to their game that they didn't want brought to their game. And it's, you know, you look at some of the corporations out there today with the sludge, or even you think about up here Hanford Nuclear up here. They could, oh, it's perfectly safe. The tanks are lined in metal. Yeah, right. Now you know different. Now you know different, but so now they're dealing with it. But so they're no different. They're a big corporation and they acted as such, but unfortunately people looked at them as being a game because they play in the streets, they play in their backyards, and they, and a lot of people can do it. And so they looked at it a little differently.
Now, when you were a player, you had a sort of an adversarial relationship to a certain extent with management. You were once fined for shaking hands with a player. What was that all about?
Well, in 1982, we were at the time fighting what they call for a percentage of the gross, because we came to the realization that it was a game, and the player and the ownership group wasn't going to take us seriously. They weren't going to look out for our future, and basically we didn't have guaranteed contracts at anything, and people didn't realize that. I mean, you go out there and you get hurt in the middle of the week, and they can cut you the following week. You're done. I mean, if you got a wife that's pregnant or you got bills you want to pay, you're done at that point. You had no protection for it. You can go out and join Cobra, but at the same time, you're done. I mean, there's no, and they could cut you any time in the course of the season. It wasn't until the last two games of the season before your contract was guaranteed. You can play 14 games, and until the very last two games, your contract is guaranteed. So we would. So 1982 was a big year for that. Also, 1982 was a big year for us having access to our medical records. It wasn't until that time after the strike that we could see the things that they did to us. I had a knee surgery in 1977, but couldn't see the results of my knee surgery, what the doctor said about it, and the things they did to me at all. They didn't have to show it to us, and they didn't show it to us. We didn't have a right to choose our own doctors who operate on us at all. So the 1982 strike allowed that to happen. So we got a chance to look at our medical records. We had a chance to have a second opinion. Didn't say we had to use someone else, but we had to have a second opinion, and that was something that none of us had before that time. So the 82 strike was looking out for some kind of security for our contracts. Was also looking at medical stability, and also, you know, what they did to the fields, because so many times when I said we played out, the guys played on dirt. And we actually played on dirt, but they would paint the fields to look like grass. They'd paint everything down. They put down this powder, what they call lime, or chalk they called it, put down. Well, stuff getting your face, getting your scraping for a long. We'd have tetanus shots every week because guys would have infections, or you get something wrong. You get these glands that get inflamed. And part of the 1982 strike was so that we would stop that from happening, and we'd be able to know what they're using on the field, and bring the experts to the table, guys from different colleges that could say these things were better for this. This is better for this. Do something different, and start looking out for player health. But it took a strike, and took a 57-day strike to make that happen. Well, how mine started was, I was a player rep. We took us to training, and we go back to the AFL-CIO, went back to the Department of Labor, and they kind of taught us how to be advocates for our players. And we come back, and I came back, and one of the things that we wanted to do that was just a simple deal was to shake hands with the other team before the kickoff. Right now, you have only the captains doing it, and that's still going on today. But if all the players want to do it, they could do it. But at that time, the captain would do it, and the team would never let anybody else do it. And even to the point, we couldn't even shake hands with the team after the game back in those days. They were not allowed. And for what reason was? Because they said fraternizing with the other team would jeopardize the integrity of the game. Just shaking hands. And we say, look, boxers shake hands before the game. They go out and beat the crap out of each other, and they hug after the game. But it hasn't changed the way they play the game. Wrestlers do the same thing. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And so there was a decision made by her union leadership and all their executive team to go out and shake hands before the games to show solidarity with their other players. And all the other teams had no problem with it. Our coach at the time, a guy named Jack Patera, had a real problem with that. And he threatened all of us in front of each other in a meeting. If we did that, he was going to fine us. And he was going to fine us a game check. Well, in preseason, you heard me say earlier on that in preseason, we're making at that time $125 a week. Well, our game checks was, in our case, tens of thousands of dollars. Well, he was going to fine us a game check. So, I mean, we played all the preseason for nothing. And so we went on and did it, and he did that. So we ended up filing a grievance with them at the National Labor Relations Board, and they finally got the NFL at that time, Pete Rozelle, to say, okay, guys, back off of this deal. And so they finally did, but he took away all of our money for training camp for anybody without shook hands, which was 98% of the team. So that's how the relationship started, and he never forgave me for that.
Wow. And so that strike, the 1982 strike, was not a strike like the baseball strike of 1990, whatever it was. 94, it wasn't a money issue.
No, it was not. Part of it was money because we wanted our contracts, at least having our contracts guaranteed. We wanted to reduce down the number of years before you could qualify for a pension. It was 5. We wanted it reduced down to 4, which we thought was legitimate considering the average length of time was 3.6 years at the time. So very few guys were getting to retirement age, was getting to retirement because they couldn't get there. So those are key issues, but at the same time, mainly it was about dignity, being able to choose your own doctors, have access to your medical records, have involvement in what goes on in the field, so when you get sick, you know why you're getting sick on the field from the way they paint the field. Those are some of the key, really, really key points that came out of the strike that we fought for at the time.
But those are some kind of complex issues in terms of getting that across to the fans. How did the fans react to your striking?
They really did. The fans came out with tremendous support from the fans. And the reason was because we aligned ourselves with everyday people. Like we sat down with the AFL-CIO, we sat down with the teachers union, we sat down with so many different groups and said, here is the issue we're looking for. Do you have the ability to choose your own doctor? Yeah. Why shouldn't we? You don't have that ability? No. Really? Do you have ability to choose who operates on you? Yeah. We don't have that ability. Really? No. Do you realize our contracts literally are not guaranteed? 0 of us contracts guaranteed. They can cut you any day. And that at the time, my wife was pregnant at the time. And I said, my wife, if I lost my job tomorrow, my insurance, I have my wife stops tomorrow. They said, you're kidding me. I said, no. They said, why would you do this sport? They said, you shouldn't be doing this sport. We said, unfortunately, this is something we're good at. I mean, it's no different than someone's a teacher, someone's a doctor. There's certain things you're good at. We're good at the sport. Why should we not have the same protections as you, as a human, as anybody else? Why should we be less human because we play the sport? And so it did, the message did get across to the public, and we had tremendous support from the public for that. And when the public don't support these type of things, it's because they look at it, well, it's going to raise my ticket price so they get more money. They're making a ton of money already. Why should they make more money? And they get all the privileges, and they never look at it from a human side of it, saying, these are basic things that really apply to everybody, and it should apply to people in all walks of life.
How has your relationship with the NFL, or if you have one, since you retired as a player?
It's been a lot better. I mean, to the point, currently I'm one of the trustees that help manage the players' retirement funds, and it's about a $4 billion fund. There's 3 trustees from the players and 3 from the owners. And then there's Roger Goodell is the moderator for the meetings, and he sends a representative each time. And I get along very well with these people all the way across the board, have for a number of years. When I left the game of football, I became part of the competition committee that helped govern some of the rules and regulations of the game. We first started with the instant replay years ago. I was on the committee that helped evaluate that. So I've spent a lot of time with a lot of the NFL owners. I think through the years, they realized that what happened to me out here was really I was a victim of circumstance, more that was not directed to me personally. It was the situation at the time, and that the fact that we had someone here, a guy named Jack Patera, that went over the board. He wanted to really show the world that, hey, don't mess with me, I'm the tough guy. And in the end, he lost. But I think the ownership, and like I said, there's a number of these guys out there, from Paul Allen here in Seattle to the Dick Cass and the Baltimore to the Ted Phillips in Chicago and on. People that I know that I can call and talk to tomorrow. I had dinner with Roger Goodell this past weekend, a little over a week ago when he came out for the Seattle New Orleans game. Had dinner with him then, so I was able to meet with him, and I've done that on several occasions since that time, so it's a very good relationship today.
And Sam McCollum, what have you done since you retired as a player? What do you do now?
Well, currently I'm at a company. We produce bottled beverages, bottled water, bottled teas, and we take water, we purify it, we put it in a bottle, and we sell it private labelly to a number of customers around the country. We have 5 facilities, and we make, as I tell people, on average about 8 million bottles a day, and we're small in the industry. That's how much is out there today. So that's what I do. I'm the executive vice president in charge of purchasing and acquisitions for the company. Before this, I owned my own company. I was in the food business for 12 years, and especially food business. I was the only kosher distributor in the Northwest for a number of years, and being black, that put me in a unique category all to itself. So it was something that I was able to grow and sold to a much bigger company as it got bigger, where it was time to be sold. And so I worked in state government after I left football. The governor of the state of Washington was someone I worked with when I was playing the game, and ended up wanting to work for him, running an agency called the Traffic Safety Commission. And we was able to pass the mandatory seatbelt laws to lower the DWI limit for driving while intoxicated, and many, many things aimed at kids in the community for safety. And I was involved in that because of my high profile in the community, and it made me give me a lot of opportunities for success. So I found ways to keep myself busy, Gary.
So do you think that being a football player prepared you for any of those things?
I think it taught me a lot about discipline, and it taught me a lot about football anyway, and just sports in general, that nothing's free. Even though it may seem like it's free, there's a price tag with it. And many times, the effort you take that you put into is what you get out of it. And I spent a lot of time, as my wife can tell you, studying, a lot of time working out when I didn't have to, and I felt I had to do extra things, like lifting weights, and a lot of time preparing myself, and all the extra time I spent growing up through the years in college and in the pros. And so it taught me a lot about discipline. And when you get into the business, nothing's ever going to go exactly the way you expect it's going to go. You got to be able to adjust to it on the fly, and sports teaches you that, because there's someone across from you that's very talented, and you're not going to beat him every time. You may only beat him 51% of the time, but that's the advantage that you need. So in the business world, same thing. You're not going to get every sale you want. You're not going to get every product you're going to launch is going to be a success. You're going to miss some, and you got to be able to bounce back, understand what happened, and learn from it, and go back at it again with a different mindset. And that's what sports taught me, and that's what business is all about.
When you and I talked a few weeks ago, you told me you didn't think the 49ers would get past the Seahawks, and it turned out you were correct. So you want to make a prediction about the Super Bowl. We're taping this before the Super Bowl, but many people will probably hear it afterwards, so they'll be able to know if you were right or wrong.
Well, being in Seattle, I'm still a Seahawks fan. I'm rooting for the Seahawks. Having played for them, I'm a diehard fan out here. I think Denver this year, because of Peyton Manning, is that little bit of, I should say, the it thing this year. I'm not quite sure the Seahawks get past them, unless, of course, the weather participates, because if the weather gets cold and windy, it neutralizes Peyton and some of the things that he's able to do, and it gives Seahawks their defense an advantage. But, you know, you've seen the weather report out there. It's iffy at best. So my heart tells me Seattle at this point. I really want to go Seattle. My gut tells me I'm not sure they get past Denver at this point.
Sam McCollum, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Gary, thank you very much, and enjoyed my time. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week. I hope you had a good time, and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. I want to thank my guest, Sam McCollum, for being on the show. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.